The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. The BioRevolution Podcast. Today, we are what we eat, the future of food. Hello, Izzy.
Hello.
Did you eat healthy today?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Since you have come to Berlin, we've been eating very unhealthily.
So sorry.
But I think I was also one of the drivers of that. I will change my ways from tomorrow on.
When I'm gone, yeah, I understand that. Yeah, I had just a piece of very, very sweet thing with a lot of nuts and chocolate. Not very healthy, not very good.
Nuts are good, chocolate.
Kicking off, we always have quotes. Also today, what did you bring?
I brought two quotes, one from William Shakespeare, "Our bodies are our gardens, our wills are our gardeners."
Nice one.
I like that. And one that seems a little bit absurd, but might be fitting one of the topics that we might discuss today, which is cultivated meat. And this is a quote from Winston Churchill, who said, "We shall escape the absurdity of growing a whole chicken in order to eat the breast or wing by growing these parts separately under a suitable medium," which sounds very
visionary.
Well, visionary. It also sounds a little bit Frankensteinish, but we'll get into that. I actually wanted to read it in the Churchill voice, but
he was drunk.
I think he was very drunk, maybe. Which I'm not so.
Not healthy.
He was, I think, the example of unhealthiness.
Yeah, but he got pretty old. I think he died in his 80s, if I remember correctly. Something. Well, there are exceptions always to rules.
Yes.
With us today, Lia Calucci, she is CEO of Food Campus Berlin. Hello.
Hello. I'm very excited to be with you too.
How are you?
Doing good.
Healthy?
There's always room for improvement, but yeah, I think I'm on a pretty healthy track.
The mega question up front, will we all be vegans in a decade or so?
It depends on who you ask. No, but being a realist, I know that animals are not going to disappear from the food chain in the near future. Mm-hmm.
But it would be good, wouldn't it?
Yes, I personally follow a vegan diet. So if you ask me personally, of course, I'm the, you know, in the idealistic world, yes, because of the moral, ethical reasons, because of the environmental reasons. But looking at the way the industry is shaped and is functioning right now, there are also some concepts, the circular animal agriculture of where you only use the land that you couldn't be using any other ways to feed animals.
And I have to say, as a non-vegan and non-vegetarian, you are a vegetarian your whole life.
Yes.
And I, as a kid, had to choose. So half of my family was always vegetarian, the other half not. And I chose not to be. But I would also completely agree that it would be much better for everyone to be vegan for all the reasons that you named and many more. And I think finding maybe ways for people like me who are not strong enough to go through with it completely, but finding little steps that we can do to make life better for animals, but also to make life more sustainable on our planet would be very, very helpful.
We're diving right into. But I think, I mean, one thing is using the word vegan is already very polarizing.
Absolutely.
So it's, I prefer to talk about a plant-rich diet. And that includes the majority of your food intake coming from plants, but that also leaves some room for animal-derived foods. And I believe we have to re-engineer our understanding of meat, because if we look at it from a medical point of view, you can see meat as an equation. That's the raw ingredients we have, plus the texture, the taste. And if we're looking at, you know, the plant-based, cell-based, fermentation-based, we're only shifting the first, the ingredients part, but the end result, meat, can be quite similar. So it's re-engineering our understanding of what we define as meat. We're only changing the raw ingredients. And that means we don't have to miss out on any of the flavors, the meat as we know it today. Things will evolve a lot.
I really, as Izzy hinted, I come from a vegetarian family, and there's indeed been a vegetarian culture in Germany in the 1920s, roughly 100 years ago. Some Far Eastern elements that they adapted that was for the whole family, was for three generations. In the 1960s, 70s, when I grew up, people, kids approached me and said, "Well, you must be poor." Because back in the day, the equivalent of being rich is having meat three times a week, every day, whatever it is. And I can see that this is changing. And I've never been a missionary that everybody should become a vegetarian or a vegan or something, but I was always interested in how that would develop, you know. And in urban Germany, you can say that it's paradise for me because I would find a zillion restaurants in every city, which wasn't true 30 years ago. So there is development.
Definitely.
Yeah, I really like the idea of reframing the whole situation a little bit because I think this strong ideology that comes, and I think, I mean, that's something that we might dive into. Food is very ideologic, right? And it's a part of your identity, what you eat. And when I like prepared for this episode, I thought about it because I'm teaching at university, and in any like lecture that we have, we end up talking about which diet is the healthiest. I don't know how that ends up because we talk about mitochondria or about cell division. And then we end up within like an hour or something talking about I'm vegan and I eat meat and who wins. And I'm like, okay, that's true, but let's take it in the break and discuss what we're discussing about right now. But I think for the younger people, really, food is identity to a certain extent. But I think from your example from the 1960s, probably it has always been identity to an extent, part of a
cultural identity. So when we socialize, we meet for beer, we meet for coffee, for dinner, for lunch. So it is that really that social glue that comes along with consuming food. But the fact that it's when people internationally think of Germany, they think of cars and beer. But now for younger generations, this is shifting. They don't automatically think of Germany as the land of cars, but also with a lot of food variety and food diversity. Berlin is the European vegan capital, and there's a lot to offer.
Which is very noticeable. And I think this is really nice because I think for me and many of my friends, not being vegan doesn't mean that you don't like to eat vegan food, right? And I think this is maybe the shift that we need and that you also mentioned. It's not about restricting or forbidding things. It's about having nice things that you can take from this. Maybe you can introduce a little bit, because you just mentioned Berlin as the vegan capital, but what's the goals of the Berlin Food Hub? So what are you aiming for with this initiative?
So I've been working in the food industry for over 15 years now. I've been a startup founder. I've worked for a big corporate. I've built an expert community. So I've really dove into these different sections of the industry. And what I've come to realize, our food industry is facing tremendous challenges, you know, lack of skilled workers, international innovation pressure. We have the climate crisis above all that is heavily affecting the entire food supply chain. And with that, you know, geopolitical instability, supply chain issues, and so on. The list goes on. And we have many good solutions for all of these challenges, but these solutions are not at scale yet. And this is where the sweet spot we are hitting with the food campus. We want to transition or catalyze that food system change. And we're doing so by building a big innovation hub here in Berlin, where we will bring the key stakeholders from science, from startups, from SMEs, from corporates, policymakers, etc., physically together to co-create those solutions. And I like to think of it, you know, that if you think of tech innovation, people think of the Silicon Valley. When you think of the world of finance, you think of Wall Street, but there is not that one place yet that people think of when they think of the future of food. And I would love Berlin to be that place.
Yeah, wow.
So cool.
When will you start? I mean, operative, and that's question A, and question B would be, is everybody really coming on board? You mentioned the players from academia, from SME, you said, from the industry, from corporates. Is everybody in? Do they dig it yet?
So when are we starting? So we're still physically constructing that building. We are aiming to open end of 2027, so okay. 2 years. Yeah. But we know that the challenges of the food system are not waiting until our campus is done. That's why we're already quite active. We doing a lot of events. We have built a digital community with over 10,000 food professionals, and we do a lot of matchmaking already. But is everyone on board? It's two-sided. I think anyone I talk to within the industry gets it automatically. They believe in the idea. Not everyone will be physically present because not for every company it makes sense to have a location in Berlin, but that's why we also have that digital expert community around it.
Are you also, so from the consumer side, do you get any feedback? Like, I mean, really from, we all eat food, we're all consumers, but is there like a kind of grassroots movement of people who are really interested in it, who would want to advocate for different types of innovation in this industry?
Definitely. So we are, I mean, we are B2B focused. So we really aim to transition the food industry. But of course, consumers are a key stakeholder in that entire dialogue. You can develop the best innovation if the consumers don't adapt it. So of course, we have also a big offer, a consumer testing hub within our campus of being able, those innovations that you create, to actually test them with consumers on the ground. And that's a competitive advantage Berlin has versus other cities, that we have big cohort of early adopters and very international people. 25% of people here in Berlin have an international background, over 170 different nations. And that means when you test something here, it's a bit of a window to the world.
True. Yeah. When it comes to stakeholders, I would be very interested to know from you. I mean, in journalism, we talk about the water mafia, and I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about. We're talking about the meat mafia. Again, I think you know what I'm talking about. Is there, from lobbying groups who are interested in maintaining the status quo, any unfriendly fire against the food campus?
So far, no, because we are really all hands on deck mindset. That means we're not against anyone. It's about bringing companies on that really want to innovate. You shouldn't only be looking at the status quo where the company currently is, but what's their strategy? You know, how do they aim to build a carbon neutral supply chain, net zero targets, et cetera, and always really dive behind the business models. And essentially, it's always, any business is people business. And there are some really, even in some of the big companies, you know, that are demonized very often, but there's some people within those companies that really drive action.
And the willingness to change.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I think what's also interesting is that, at least in Germany, and I don't know if that's true in other countries as well, but the providers of plant-based meat solutions are often the ones who classically were processing meat products. Having this shift of mindset to be aware that you need to offer alternatives to your customers.
In Germany, we have the beautiful example of Rügenwalder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's who I was thinking about.
It's a reaction on pressure from the street at the end of the day, because they acknowledge, okay, we have a percentage of vegans, of vegetarians, so we got to act in order to keep up our business.
And I think it's always, I mean, just looking at solely economically from a business perspective, it's a completely smart decision to diversify. You're not destroying your own business model. You're diversifying the offering and you're catering to more consumer needs.
Yeah.
And again, these are products, I mean, that I also eat as a non-vegetarian or non-vegan, because some of them are tasty. So then it's really
And every just time an I come to visit in Berlin, we go out and we have at least one vegetarian or vegan dinner, and it's delicious what Berlin has to offer. So again, the melting pot for the transformation of the food industry.
In the food camps, we will also have a canteen. So because we're planning with 1,000 to 1,500 people.
I sign up, I come.
And that canteen will also be open to the public. If you talk about the future food, you have to be able to taste it and experience it. You have to eat. So really bringing all of these innovations onto a plate and into the people's mouths is what we're aiming for.
If you dig a little deeper in the vegan movement, for instance, avocado has gotten very popular. Almonds are very popular. But when you look beyond the surface, there's some points where you think, okay, when I want to get to addressing the topic of climate change, almonds, not so good. For instance, are you addressing those topics as well, holistically?
Of course, you know, when I talk about the challenges of the food system, the environmental issue is one of the big ones. And our food system is the single largest contributor to climate change. We have over 30% of greenhouse gas emissions that directly are linked to our food system, and half of that coming from the animal business. Then we have over 70% of the biodiversity loss. Mm-hmm. So the animals and plants that are dying out, 70% is linked to our food system. We have the same with water, fresh water use. Over 70% of the fresh water that is used is used for agriculture and food production. So you cannot not look at the environmental aspects when you talk about food. I'm a very optimistic person. So, you know, if you see all that negative influence, that also means there's a lot of room for improvement and actually to be meeting our climate goals if we shift those layers.
If we stay in the picture, would that mean no more almonds or no more almonds in the Central Valley in California, but at places where it rains actually? Or would it mean like a third path?
We think a lot of the almonds and the avocados, but we need to first tackle actually the bigger issues, which is the meat industry. And I think this is where our focus should be going. I've been working on a project actually with the Almond Board of California, and they're doing a lot of research onto how can we grow almonds with significantly less water. It's again, the first thing we have in our mind, but we need to look at the bigger chunks first before we're looking at the others. There's a friend of mine is working on cell-based avocado.
That is so interesting.
I mean, it's going to take a while until the regulatory framework is going to allow him to bring that to market. But we've seen that with cacao. You know, there's alternative cacao companies that are going through the roof now because cacao prices have risen by 300%.
I sign up for cell-based coffee and cell-based avocado. That would make me happy. That would suffice.
But we have to get to the meat. So we're moved from California. We're moving south to the Pampa in Argentina and discuss what we can do there, except raising cattle, or what would be better also there. And then, of course, the biorevolution comes into play when it comes to meat and meat replacement. And there are some developments that are, I would call it breathtaking.
One thing that we also, I think, have to consider when we talk about eating meat, I mean, that it's, I mean, not sustainable. There's a high likelihood of food shortage or meat shortages at some point because it's just, I mean, too many people, too little space. But I think from my background, where it's more about like health related, we also should consider that eating red meat, which I do because I like it, but I'm also aware that it's actually quite unhealthy. It's good for getting fast protein, but it's actually negatively correlated to many health factors. And there's a big study that was just done with over 100,000 participants over 30 years that correlates certain food groups to healthy aging. And red meat for sure is one that is actually negatively correlated within this study. And there is the factor, and we talked about antibiotics a couple of times on this podcast, that traditional animal housing, transport, etc., unfortunately requires antibiotics in many cases, even though in the EU it's forbidden to give them without a reason. But if you put a lot of animals together, then there is a high likelihood that they will get sick and that you consume the antibiotics the meat and through the dairy and through the eggs that you consume, which again is not good for our health. And then there's also this pathogen issue that, I mean, putting a lot of animals together has the risks of zoonosis and also of other pathogens that you might again consume via the meat. And this is also part of the equation that even though protein, I think, is good for you, meat might on the long run not be the healthiest way.
At least meat, animal-derived meat. So I like to think of it, we're still going to be consuming meat. It's just changing a raw ingredient. That's just one part of the equation. Mm-hmm. And that, in a positive note, with some of the cell-based, the plant-based, the fermentation-based options that are only getting better from here, there is so much opportunity. And we can lower the cholesterol. We can really ensure that there's no antibiotics involved. And you can upscale the positive, the unsaturated fatty acids. You can improve them, dial them up. So you can really re-engineer meat also to be meeting the consumer's health targets.
Can you maybe briefly describe these three routes that you indicated, the plant-based, lab-based or cell-based and the fermentation-based ones?
So it's plant-based. I think it's very self-explanatory using plant-based sources. Currently, it's mostly soy or pea protein that is used, but there's
lentils also maybe a little bit too.
Yes, but it's mostly peas and soy on a large scale. But there's a lot of experiments and companies also from oat using more local grains from a lot of beans and lentils, legumes in general. anything you can extract proteins from. I think what is also always important to know is just a little side note, and then I come back to the explanation is meat has been, animal-based meat has been professionalized or perfected over thousands of years. And the whole world of alternatives is only 20 years old, or not even 16 years. Beyond Meat launched the first burger in 2009. And that was a product, if you look at the label, that was not clean label. That is something hardly anyone would still eat today. But within those 16 years, we have significantly improved already. And just because someone tried an alternative meat product 5 years ago, the products on the market today are not the same anymore. So this is why I always encourage people to give that category also some time to improve. And products are only getting better from here. There are some companies really clean label. They even higher in protein content than animal products. They have the exact same texture, taste. And yeah, as I said, all the negative elements are dialed down. So that's plant-based as one category. Then we have fermentation-based. And there we separate between precision fermentation and biomass fermentation. And precision fermentation-based products, many of them, and we live in the EU, are still not allowed to be hitting the market. Many companies operating in that space are going to Singapore first, because Singapore is like a sandbox. Singapore has its own food strategy because they don't have agricultural land. So in order to actually be independent, they have a strategy of 30% of foods should be coming from Singapore by 2030. And that's why they're super open to all of these new innovations, vertical farming, cell-based, because that allows them to actually produce food within their own country. But only Singapore is a limited market. So many of the companies operating in that space, yes, you can test your products there, but the palate of someone in Singapore is also not directly translatable to someone in Europe. So it really is regulatory challenges. And then the same goes for cell-based products. So you originally, cell-based, how it works, you take through a biopsy, you take a cell from an animal, then you grow it in a medium. And from there, you have a scaffold that you're growing it in. And it's essentially the exact same meat product, but just, you know, without it being cultivated in physical animal body, but in a bioreactor.
Which is basically exactly what Churchill was asking for, probably after drinking half a bottle of whiskey. This is so interesting.
I understand that this is still this procedure that might be for hardcore meat eaters the most appealing for now, I would say. I guess that's still very expensive, isn't it?
It's the financial part. Now, and yes, and it is not a lot of communication. That's your daily business, but it is, people think of lab meat. Mm-hmm. We have a romanticized view and perception of when we think of meat, we think of, you know, happy cows on a field. But that is 3% of the animals. 97% is heavy industry.
Look at chicken. It's even worse. Yeah.
But it's exactly what I was discussing, like this. I mean, you have this like Frankenfood image of the evil stuff from the lab. And then you imagine this cow that's happy somewhere in the Bavarian countryside. And in reality, what happens to the cow is Frankenfood. I mean, you did this feature, right, about animal transports.
After doing this research and accompanying the cattle from the Czech Republic to France and how they were treated, I quit milk because I really had a visible understanding why we have milk in the first place. And so I quit milk at that point.
It is many of those things. Once you see, you can't unsee it.
Yes, true. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think here really the reputation, I think maybe of the lab grown proteins, which doesn't only have to be meat, right? It could also be fish and other. I mean, I didn't know about the avocado, but it makes complete sense. And I love it as an idea. Also would look pretty. Yeah. I think for me, from a scientific perspective, this is really, really interesting. This possibility to just use the stem cells and grow out
course.
A piece of meat. And yes, I think at the moment it's probably still expensive, but any novel thing will be expensive. And as soon as you can scale it, I think it will be reduced in cost. And I mean, we also have to say that at the moment, meat from animals is cheap because we produce it or we treat the animals in a way that's cheap. And if we would pay the realistic price for the cow who gets to stand on the green field, it would also be much more expensive. I don't know if it's the same as for the, I only had this price tag of the first burger from University of Maastricht in, when was it, 2013?
That first
was
cell-based burger, yeah.
First cell-based burger that was 330,000 euros.
We are significantly down from that.
We're at 200,000.
No,
but it's still, it's, you know, but in Singapore, because that's one of the, you know, test markets where you see a lot of these innovations, we have companies that are doing hybrid products because of the high price point of cell-based. They can't fully offer it yet, but they are doing, you know, a certain percentage of a food. One part is plant-based and the other part is cell-based. This, I believe, is where it's an intermediate solution because you can bring that full mouse feeling of animal derived and combination with plant-based, and you hit still are within a price range that is affordable.
I mean, as a lifelong vegetarian, I don't give a sh about the taste or
you're not the target.
I'm not the target.
So, I actually remember that you once had this. It was like when Beyond Meat came in Holland, and you ate like a piece of chicken that tasted way too much like chicken, and you asked three times, "Is this meat? I don't want to eat it."
I know.
And then I ate it because you found it too close to the.
Oh, you have to try. There's a plant-based steak. You had said, okay. I couldn't even be eating it because for me it was like this is like meat.
In the U.S., people called me the lettuce head. The final target of all this, of course, is feeding a world of 10 to maybe 11 and a half. Scientific discourse as we speak. When will be the tipping point? We don't really know it, but I do believe that after 11 billion, the world is not going to grow anymore. There are some fair aspects that pay into this. And feeding a world like that is a challenge and is an extra challenge if we want to fight climate change at the same time, of course, as we all know. For me, a lot of ideas are flipping through my head, everything we discussed right now. But in addition to that, for instance, saltwater resistant rice plants in the floodplains, for instance, I guess even at the cost that we wouldn't have native rice anymore at some point, that will probably be the price we will have to pay in order to feed 11 billion. What's your take on that?
A few thoughts on that. So if the population growth happens, as you just mentioned, we don't have enough farmland to actually feed those 10 to 11 billion people. And if we continue business as usual, as we do it right now, 40% of the farmland we globally have isn't going to be unusable. So you have population growth versus available land. So we need innovation. That's just,
it's a given.
It's a given.
Of course.
You don't need to negotiate anymore. We need to diversify the offers. So we're not in a position yet where we can say this is the only way and we're only going cell-based meat. No, we have to try all the different opportunities we have. And then the best option in the end will win. But that's how innovation works. You really test and explore in all different areas. And of course, GMO is one of those categories that needs to be researched on.
Yeah, I think in Europe and in Germany specifically, we have this anti-GMO attitude, which is also a little bit short-sighted because we get a lot of GMO modified plants, I mean, products from the US and from other parts of the world, which are part of the products that we consume anyway. So
it's also in looking in terms of building climate resistant plants that grow within Europe. Here in Berlin, we're going to have climate that is closer to Italy in the coming years. So, and our agriculture plants are not used to that climate. So we, of course, need to do research on climate adaptive plants.
I'm just thinking about the quality of the Cabernet Sauvignon from Brandenburg.
I was also thinking maybe we can have some wine production because the big study also showed that wine is not negatively correlated.
Red wine.
Red
they
wine.
Pointed out, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure if it was, but
it's not negatively correlated with what?
It's not negatively correlated with healthy aging. So if we would
grow
some wine in Ireland, it would still be fine.
That's because of the polyphenols. It would be better if it's alcohol-free wine.
Of course, yes, absolutely.
Maybe we can dive a little bit into one other trend next to having alternative proteins, which I think is absolutely fascinating. But I think something that could also be of interest is this idea of personalizing nutrition a little bit, because we talk a lot, somehow it comes up again and again, and I get it from my students. Should I eat this? Should I eat this? Should I take this supplement? This idea of what's good for me, is it good for everyone? And I think we for a long time got this dietary advice that was very much one size fits all. And that was also following trends that everyone was eating no fat and then everyone was eating no carbs. And now I think a lot of people eat very high protein diets. And the question, is that actually good for anyone or for everyone? Probably it's good for some, but not so good for others. And is that something, this trend of personalized nutrition that you're exploring within the Food Campus as well?
Definitely, it's something we're exploring because it's not only a trend, it's a strong leverage we have to improve the health of society. Looking at it from a meta perspective, there is this really impressive number. So our food system creates $15 trillion every year in externalized cost. And 70% of those are health related costs. You know, 15 trillion is a number none of us can really grab. But that means if we look at the revenue of the food system, a global food system, for every euro we generate in value, it costs us $1.50 equivalent. So we see only looking mathematically, it doesn't make sense. And these are externalized costs. So they're not in the true cost accounting. We're not paying for those, but we're indirectly paying them with, you know, of course, our health, with the rise of diabetes, of cardiovascular diseases. And then, of course, those health related costs that come along. So also from me personally, from a very idealistic point of view, I would love if we aim through personalized nutrition, ensure that people eat more tailored to their own metabolism and to their own dietary needs, that of course frees up a lot of capital that could be allocated elsewhere. So personalized nutrition is definitely a key trend or topic, that I wouldn't even call it a trend. It's a key future topic that we're addressing. And there's always that beautiful comparison that our metabolism and our nutrition is as unique as our fingerprint. So, you know, everyone knows our fingerprint is unique. And that is the same goes for nutrition. And you said it, the first nutrition recommendation happened after the war or during the war, Second World War, because people were completely undernourished. And that was the first time governments actually thought about, okay, we need micronutrients and how do we ensure that the society doesn't get sick? That was the first level of when governments handed out nutrition recommendations. But this, you know, we have evolved, science has evolved, and there's a lot of different levels of how you can personalize.
How do we talk? I'm personally interested because I'm the last year of the boomers that you count as boomers. We are all going into retirement the few upcoming years. How do you talk those people into taking care of their metabolisms? Because none of my generation, and I mean, behind this is not a joke question, because obviously we have massive problems with our health systems, and the goal, and we're discussing this in this podcast very many times, the goal is to keep people as healthy as long as possible and not having chronic diseases for 10, 15 years and then people die. Does make sense. The awareness question is behind that, of course. So how do we achieve that?
Yeah. And also maybe that's, I think for me also one of the really big questions around that. I mean, how do we make that more successful than other diets? Because I think the challenge, the huge question with diets, and we had a episode on Ozempic where I dove a little bit into how well do diets work. It turns out not very well, because they all work well as long as you do it. And people have a hard time changing their lifestyles, it turns out. So how do you think this personalized approach will actually help overcome that?
It's all a matter of convenience. It has to be adaptable, and that has to be convenient in a way that people can integrate it into their daily life. Diets, regular diets, following a rigid diet plan, as you said, works for 3 weeks, whatever you do it. And afterwards, you're not integrating it into your daily life. So when we talk about personalized nutrition, there are very different levels. We can start with what do I like? What do I not like? Yes, you're a vegetarian. You eat meat. So that's already a level of personalization. That's not where you get the big health benefits from. But then we have anthropometrical data. So it's just my height, my weight, my BMI. Then there are clinical parameters like the glucose level. There's a super big study that was done in Israel from the Weizmann Institute that has really given a boost to the whole personalized nutrition topic. And they showed that people after eating the same meal had a completely different glucose response. And that was really interested in, yeah.
Yeah, this is, I also saw this, and this is so interesting, right? Because you say like no one should eat white bread, and probably, I mean, we all shouldn't eat a lot of white bread, but I think it has very different effects, or rice. I think also spikes for some people and for others doesn't. And
that's why it's, I know it's always not the easy answer, but it's really as unique as our fingerprint. And we need to keep that in mind. That what is good for me is not automatically good for everyone else.
And I think also the microbiomes, right?
Play a huge role. That is like the deepest level you can go into is really the microbiome.
Knowing which bacteria are helpful to digest which foods. And I think I just dove into that a little bit for my teaching and realized that some vitamins can only be produced with the help of your gut bacteria. So that would actually motivate me to treat them well if I want my vitamins produced. Absolutely. So yeah, now that's super interesting. And I mean, I would really hope that I think one of the things that I see as a challenge here, but this is true for many of the things that we've been talking about, and I'm sure that you also have some thoughts on that, is the accessibility. Mm-hmm. So is it something that, I mean, will benefit the selected few who have the education and have the money to go for it, or can we make it accessible to other people? And I think, I mean, in Germany, I think it's still a little bit better, but if we lived in the US for a while, and there are regions where you cannot get fresh food.
In my mind was just popping up the picture of the city of Detroit, where you would have, first off, a city built for 2 million, where 700,000 people live, actually, and where you would have miles and miles with Burger Kings and MCDs, but you would have an Eastern market that probably is like 25 miles from where I live and where I could buy fresh produce.
If you can afford it.
If you can afford it on top. So this is kind of the super bad vision of postmodern cities that might evolve at one place or the other. But of course, we have to address these questions as well.
Definitely. And I think the whole topic of personalized nutrition is nothing new. It has been around for decades. Nonetheless, now we're at a level with machine learning and AI. There is all these data sets can be analyzed. And that, of course, brings up efficiency, that lowers cost, and that makes some of these applications of personalized nutrition more affordable. We're still in a phase where it's a lifestyle factor. It's for high income target audiences. Yeah. Nonetheless, again, looking at, the 70% of externalized costs of foods are health related. Personalized nutrition is of interest of also some of the health insurance companies also here in Germany, because it is a big leverage they have in, reducing their own costs. And it needs to go into these preventive measures also on a governmental level. Otherwise, it's still going to remain a lifestyle element.
And I think you can also think about really implicating it more into the healthcare system itself. I mean, having, for example, in a hospital, more nutrition. I mean, I think all of us who have been in a hospital, I think maybe it's gotten better, but the last time I was there, the food was not very nutritious somehow. And I think, I mean, that should be the place where you're cared for on all levels.
There are companies working on that.
Yeah.
Yes. More and more people joining hands. So there should be room for some optimism. But I guess coming to a close for this episode, which is really fascinating, we could keep on talking, I think, for a few hours without a doubt. But this is not...
We'll do that when the canteen is ready.
Absolutely. But closing this, I would really like you to paint a future vision picture a little bit for us, because there's so many factors coming together when it comes to sustainable and good food future for a majority of people.
If we think future, and if you dive into all the climate situation, it can look very dystopian. Nonetheless, I personally believe it's better to be an optimist and wrong than to be a pessimist and right. So I like to paint a positive picture of the future. And that goes as follows, that we managed to move our food system, transition our food system from where we are currently to a state where it actually feeds and nourishes those 10 to 11 billion people that we're going to have on our planet, and it doesn't destroy the environment. And I know by looking at many of these initiatives and companies and innovations that already exist, we have the basis. We can get there. It's just a matter of bringing them into scale in the time that we have left. And this is what, you know, we're doing for the German and the European ecosystem, but there are many comparable hubs and initiatives. Also, governments really taking action on a global scale. And this is why I believe we have still a window of opportunity to change that picture for good.
I hear you.
I like it.
So thank you very, very much for your deep dive into how we eat, what we eat in the future, and also the kind of personal exchange and your hopes and your academic work and bringing together all players at one table. Fascinating journey, to say the least. And I guess we'll be back in 27.
Would be nice.
And speak again if you are.
You're also welcome before that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We are what we eat, the future of food. Thank you very much again, Lia Carlucci, CEO of Food Campus Berlin.
Thank you. It was fun talking to you.
Also, thank you as always, Izzy. It was a pleasure to sit down with you two here in Berlin. And we'll be continuing this discussion also here at the BioRevolution podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And we'll be back soon, right?
Absolutely.